After a few days of temperatures in the 70s here in mid-Michigan, you might be surprised to learn that the area between St. Ignace and Mackinac Island is still nothing but ice. Ellen Krieger reports in today's Detroit Free Press that not one ferry is running yet. Service usually starts April 21st, so we're a few days behind on the first ferry transport between St. Ignace and the island. Indeed, some ice may be 3 feet thick between St. Ignace and the island. The U.S. Coast Guard is sending an icebreaker to go to work on it. Many residents say they've never seen it like this, but some merchants are still promising they'll be selling fudge on May 1st. And May 1st is really not that far away. I'm thinking 3 feet of ice, selling fudge by, I don't know about that. Welcome to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We have an interesting show for you planned today. Later this hour, Saturday is World Tai Chi Day. We'll learn about what's planned for an East Lansing commemoration at Patriarch Park. It'll be a great opportunity to learn about Tai Chi. At the top of our program today, if you were a fan of the 1980s TV show Knight Rider, you'll remember actor David Hasselhoff riding around in a modified Pontiac Firebird Trans Am that could talk and fly and even scan other vehicles. It was cutting-edge TV sci-fi at the time, but so-called smart cars are not that far away, minus the flying, at least so far. The city of Ann Arbor is emerging as a global leader in connected vehicle technology. The concept is that cars can talk wirelessly with each other and with other parts of the traffic system to adjust to road conditions and avoid accidents. The University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute has just wrapped up an international symposium on CV technology, and joining us to talk about this budding field is the Institute's director, Dr. Peter Swetman. Welcome to Current State, Dr. Swetman.
Good morning, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you give us a good working description of what connected vehicle technology is and maybe an example or two of how it could be used?
Absolutely. So what's happening is that the vehicle is getting what we call situation awareness. So it's a short range technology that recognizes other vehicles and features of the infrastructure, such as intersections and so on, can recognize on a pretty rapid basis. So these vehicles are sending messages 10 times a second, showing the position of other vehicles, and your vehicle automatically calculates whether another vehicle is rapidly moving towards it or moving away from it and so on. So the kinds of things that we kind of do instinctively as drivers, the vehicle is doing for you. Of course, we don't need to know who these other vehicles are. We just know that they're there in the immediate vicinity. So it works well between vehicles. So, for example, to avoid a collision, a rear-end collision or a side impact collision, with what we call V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle communication. Also, the other possibilities relate to, say, intersections where, you know, if somebody's running a red light, then you'll get a warning from the intersection, and possibly even your brakes might be applied automatically in an extreme case. So, they're the kind of examples that we're thinking about.
As some of our listeners know, the city of Ann Arbor already has a large, intricate, connected vehicle test system. What results are we seeing there so far?
Well, Mark, it's been working pretty well. We've had nearly 3,000 vehicles connected in Ann Arbor for 20 months now, running continuously. And we're doing that for the U.S. Department of Transportation. They've funded this study. It's called the Safety Pilot Model Deployment. And, you know, in that we have cars, of course, and we have freight trucks, we have transit buses, we have motorcycles, and we even have one bicycle connected. And our idea is that we would extend it to pedestrians as well. So as the technology becomes suitable to embed in a smartphone, then we can extend it to anyone who's carrying a personal device. So right now in Ann Arbor, we've been collecting this data for, as I said, for 20 months, and on the 3rd of February this year, the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Secretary of Transportation, announced that they intend to move to a rulemaking process so that this very beneficial platform could be installed in all vehicles from a certain date in a few years' time.
So these are privately owned vehicles, commercial vehicles, the whole gamut, already using this technology for 20 months.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a mix. So the vehicles that we've put out include some. There's an automotive industry consortium called CAMP in our region here, and so they put a number of these vehicles together. And we got volunteers to drive them as if they were their own vehicles. But the vast majority of the vehicles we have out there are people's own vehicles that we've equipped. So not only can you fit this sort of technology at the factory, if you like, by the original equipment manufacturer, but you can retrofit it, or there are aftermarket devices available. So, and in fact, you know, that's an important aspect of this because, as you could imagine, if we're going to just simply rely on penetration of new vehicles coming into the vehicle fleet on the road, it's going to take quite a while before we get to a high density of connected vehicles. But if we're able to get some aftermarket devices out there, then we can kind of accelerate the benefits very rapidly.
Do you consider the safety advantages of this technology its primary benefit?
Yes. So obviously this technology is being considered and tested all around the world, but I think the United States stands out because we have a very clear focus on safety. So there are many other benefits from this kind of technology, but we're really doing it from the basis that the U.S. Department of Transportation has estimated that this technology can address 80% of serious multi-vehicle unimpaired crashes. So it's really the biggest ticket item since seatbelts, anti-lock brakes, and so on came into vehicles and saved a lot of lives. This technology is really the next big thing in motor vehicle safety.
Our guest on Current State is Dr. Peter Swetman. Dr. Swetman is the director of the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. We're talking about all of the work they're doing in Ann Arbor on connected vehicle technology. I beg your pardon. When you talk to the larger public about this idea, what do they tend to make of it?
Well, they're extremely excited about it. So, as I said, we've got nearly 3,000 volunteers here in Ann Arbor, and a number of them are, well, most of them, in fact, are parents from the Ann Arbor Public School System. A number of them are also employees of the University of Michigan health system. And so they say to us, well, what's next? You know, they hear about automated vehicles and so on, and I think there's a sense of excitement around for these new technologies. So I think we get a general sense of bring it on, and the indications are, and certainly there have been some studies with consumers related to this technology that indicate a very high level of acceptance and a certain degree of willingness to pay for it as well, which is always important.
You must encounter the occasional critic who must think that smart cars are no substitute for a live, thinking, reacting human being. How do you tend to respond to them?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think when you tell people that at least 80% and probably 90% of serious crashes are caused by human error, then people realize that this technology is going to be a lot more reliable than the human. And so it doesn't take much to convince people of that. You know, we hear about it also with aircraft and automated landing and takeoff of aircraft and so on. So I think there are a number of areas where automation is coming in and is being accepted. So our impression, too, is that Americans are rather keen on this kind of technology that lets them do other things with their time and be more productive. So maybe even more than other countries, I think Americans are ready for this and will really appreciate it. And so we're going to see not only this connected technology, but we're going to see an increasing level of automation coming in gradually. And this connected technology is great because it really does a lot to support the automated side of things and to really bring that on faster.
Another opportunity to multitask is what it
is. Yeah, that's right. So not everyone will be thrilled about that, you know, but I think most people will be happy about that.
Do you envision the day then when the entire U.S. transportation infrastructure becomes CV friendly or becomes equipped with this technology?
When this technology is coming out in every original equipment vehicle, so it's available, so the platform's available, that's going to make a huge difference. The other side of it, Mark, is that we really do need to have deployment of a certain amount of this technology, wireless units of a particular type, in the infrastructure, on the roadsides. And that's something that, you know, at our symposium the last couple of days, really emerged that in the past 12 months since we had our last get-together, the vehicle-to-vehicle side has moved extremely well, and we're very excited. But the vehicle-to-infrastructure side isn't moving fast enough. So it's very important that we find ways to get this technology deployed in the infrastructure. As you could well imagine, at a time when potholes and maintenance is on people's minds, it's hard to talk about spending money on other kinds of technology that would go in the roadsides. And one of the interesting things that came out of our symposium is that there is a pretty interesting business case for this kind of deployment on the infrastructure side. So, because there are many, many services that can be supported via this kind of wireless communication, because it's a very secure, robust form of wireless communication that can be used for other forms of transactions with vehicles. So,
what are you grappling with, though, on this front? Is security, for example, does that topic come up? Is that a concern?
Well, security was an issue from day one, and you know, so this technology has been worked on intensively for 10 years now by the group that we're working with. And that was designed in right from the word go. So, and of course, over that period of time, the general subject of cybersecurity has just, you know, risen to the top of the public agenda in the whole nation. So, fortunately, you know, this has been a key part of everything we've done. So, there's a very capable security system built into this, so that there is absolutely no chance of identifying or retaining any of this information.
Fascinating stuff. We want to thank our guest, Peter Swetman. Peter is the director of the Transportation Research Institute at the University of Michigan, and he's at the cutting edge of connected vehicle technology in Ann Arbor and elsewhere. Dr. Swetman, many thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. It's no secret that Michigan State University has a growing body of international students. There are about 4,300 Chinese students alone enrolled at MSU. It's a trend that's prompting faculty and the staff to reevaluate how they respond to the challenges of educating this growing segment. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me with more. Kevin, I understand MSU faculty members were surveyed about their experiences relating to international students.
Yes, that's true. The MSU University Committee on Faculty Affairs surveyed more than 1,200 instructors about their experience. More than 65% said they were eager to learn more about how to better teach this population. Less than a quarter of those who responded said they were completely prepared for this type of work. Recently, MSU held a seminar on this topic, and I met with the keynote speaker, Bridget Fletcher. She's an assistant director of student services at Duke University in North Carolina. And she says when it comes to handling a large influx of Chinese students, MSU is not unique.
At Duke, we've seen the same sort of growth, and at different conferences and with different colleagues that I know from across the country, this is definitely a phenomenon that is happening across the country. So today, that number does not surprise me, but 5 years ago, when we started hearing these numbers, it absolutely did.
Specifically, Chinese students, why are we seeing an influx mainly from that country alone?
I think there's a number of things at play there. First of all, I think there are so many Chinese students that are really well positioned and really competitively interested in succeeding at school. And I think there's only so many Chinese universities, and to some extent, China's not able to accommodate all of them. I think also the appeal of studying abroad and studying in the U.S., particularly for those going into business or finance, is really strong. The U.S. is ranked very high in terms of engineering, which is another very popular popular program with a lot of those students. So I think there's a lot at play here. I think the U.S. is an appealing place to a lot of these young Chinese people.
Michigan State University's University Committee on Faculty Affairs conducted a survey of professors here on campus about the types of challenges that they face when they instruct foreign students. More than 1,200 professors responded. That's about a 50% rate. That's a pretty good rate.
Yeah, I'll say.
They reported that there are definitely some benefits to bringing a global perspective and experience to their classroom, but they also said there were some challenges to language proficiency being one of them. Do we see the English language skills, verbal and written, of Chinese students improving on the whole?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to keep in mind a couple of things when it comes to language proficiency as well. So first, the context of the Chinese educational system in general and the way that it teaches English, it is very much about memorization and reproduction. So they are basically learning things, including English, in order to be assessed on it, to take tests on it, not necessarily to use it functionally. And so I think one of the biggest challenges we have is that a lot of these students are coming to the U.S. They have a lot of what they need. They have the grammar rules, they have the vocabulary, they've learned all of that, but they haven't actually been able to use English to transact daily life, to express opinions, to manage relationships, that sort of thing. And I think that becomes very overwhelming to them when they first get here. And I think sometimes that presents as a lower proficiency than is actually there. And I think what we're tasked with is trying to help suss out some of that talent that's actually there and in there, and they have the skill set, but just have not been able to use it. I was talking to my friend Ross the other day, and I think we found a great way to sort of explain this concept. If you think about what it's like when you learn how to drive, you get your driver's manual, you learn the rules, you take your test, your parents take you out on country roads and back parking lots, you know, to practice, and you feel good, you feel confident, you pass your driver's test. Imagine suddenly going from that situation to having to drive through downtown Manhattan. I think that's a little bit what the English use is like for a lot of these students, and I think that's a disconnect that we really need to be working through, and I think we're getting better at that. And so I think we're really seeing a lot of improvement in the way that students are communicating with us on campuses, because I think we're getting better at building up their confidence and helping them access what the skills they already have and they brought with them.
Are there cultural differences among international students, specifically Chinese students, that lead professors in universities to question their honesty? We are learning that plagiarism is a big problem, and that to some degree it's cultural in nature, and that the Chinese think that it's not only appropriate to plagiarize, but that it's disrespectful to not use the work of other people in that way.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge cultural underpinning that's very hard for us to understand in the U.S. And I think we can't expect that we can flip a switch on students when they get here, and that, you know, maybe 1 hour of talking about academic honesty or plagiarism during orientation is not enough. And I think this is something that we, you know, in U.S. universities really need to work on and need to find ways of providing very specific examples of what this looks like here, providing very specific examples of what happens when people violate these sorts of policies, which will certainly be institutionally specific. And I think that's a real challenge for us. But I think we just can't expect that these students can just suddenly, you know, like I said, flip a switch and get it, because it's a completely different system.
So there is a very distinct cultural shock when they come to this country, and the expectation is you do your own research, you do your own work. If you have to cite someone else's work, you have to attribute, and that's mm-hmm. just simply not part of the norm there?
It's certainly not part of the norm, and I think we further confuse things by also having such a strong emphasis on collaboration and group work. And so I think it's confusing because on the one hand, you're encouraging students to work together, often requiring them to work together in some settings, and then in others forbidding it and punishing it. And so I think it's our job as faculty and administrators to make sure that we're very clear about when collaboration is okay and when it isn't.
Just to go back to this survey that MSU conducted, and again, I realize that you were not privy to the specifics of that of that study, but only about 24% of the MSU faculty who responded said that they felt completely prepared to teach and evaluate international students, but two-thirds, 66%, said that they want to learn more about this process. Does that encourage you that a school like MSU is taking the steps to improve the training for faculty when they work with foreign students?
Absolutely. It is delightful to hear that information. This is an issue that goes beyond MSU, beyond Duke. I mean, I think it's something that we as a country, you know, need to manage better. And I think faculty are a huge part of that. And so I think their excitement about it and their commitment to, you know, making some changes to try to help, you know, help these students be successful here, I think is really very encouraging and something I was very excited to see.
Is there a flip side to this? Do we see a large number of American students doing more than just a study abroad for a semester or two program where they want to make a long-term commitment to going to a foreign country and assimilating as best they can?
I wish there were more of that. I think it's a great experience for people. I don't work and study abroad, so it's hard for me to say. The trending that I see doesn't necessarily suggest a big uptick in that happening. But I also think to some extent there are students who are a little bit hip to, you know, the direction the world is taking, which is internationalization. And so I think it's really beneficial for students, particularly those maybe interested in technology or supply chain or engineering or, you know, really a lot of the STEM fields in particular, to take an interest in international countries and to think about maybe doing an international rotational program shortly after graduation or spending longer than a semester, kind of a little bit more meaningful period of time in a foreign country. Because I think, you know, I think people learn a lot about themselves when they travel internationally, and I think a lot of domestic students could really benefit from that experience, and so I hope we see that rise more.
But I guess this links back to the idea that there is no international or internationally accepted sets of standards about how you conduct your studies, how you conduct your business affairs in various countries that everyone in the world accepts.
Right.
And I guess that's really the basis of why we have difficulty explaining and translating our value system to international students.
That is so true. I actually just got back from France, where we were doing some recruiting for Duke, and I was so surprised to learn just how very different the French system is. I feel like I've spent a lot of time studying China, and I guess was not hugely surprised to learn that China was so different. But in France, the educational system is different, the way people get jobs is different, everything about it. And so I think, yeah, to your point, absolutely, there's not a standard, accepted, sort of universal approach to any of this. And I think that is absolutely part of what our challenge is.
What did you hear today from some of the faculty who took the time to be here and learn more about this?
I heard some great things. There were some really good ideas. It seemed like there were faculty very interested in taking creative approaches to not only helping their Chinese students acclimate, but to keeping their domestic students really engaged too. There was one woman who mentioned a project where she was talking about the Renaissance and found that her students from China didn't necessarily have much to say about it. And so she decided that in order to get them involved, that she was going to make a timeline going around her room. And on the bottom part, she was going to fill in information about the Renaissance, kind of go by century, that sort of thing. And then on the top, she had the Chinese students come in, add their sort of history along that timeline. And that was helpful for her. It was helpful for the other students. Everybody felt involved and engaged and was participating. I made everyone give her a round of applause because I was so impressed with that idea. I think that's absolutely the kind of creative approach that we need to really integrating these students and keeping our domestic students involved as well.
Bridget Fletcher is the Assistant Director of Student Services at Duke University. Bridget, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Take a drive through Lansing Township north of the Capitol and you're likely to pass by a stately, classical revival-style mansion. Beginning in 1855, the Turner Dodge House on North Street was home to several generations of one of Lansing's most prominent families. Today, it's an interpretive center with its own spot on the National Register of Historic Places. And now, the mansion's former curator has written a new book on the life and times of the Turner family. Elizabeth Homer is the author of Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires, which officially launches on Tuesday. Elizabeth Homer, welcome to Current State.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Give us an overview of the Turner family. It's easy to get the impression they were kind of the Kennedy family of the 19th century, at least here in mid-Michigan. Tell us about this.
That's a good characterization. The story is about they were very progressive. They were Western New Yorkers. They were abolitionists. And they came here at the time of statehood. And then they came to our state capital when the state was moving the capital in 1847.
From Detroit to Lansing.
And that's about all we know about it. And this is about what really occurred. And so the Turners were part of a group that came here from Western New York. And among other things, they founded the Republican Party and were far more active in politics than we would have imagined. The story of the beginning of our capital is one we don't know. If you think about it, our state, the people who live here, have no real heartwarming good story about how our capital was founded. And that part of the pioneers part of the book, which is Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires, is about the founding of the book of the capital.
By the standards of the time, though, the Turners were wealthy people.
No,
they were not.
Okay. They were in most of the first part of the book. They were not.
Where does the millionaires in the title come from?
That comes from the second part of the book.
Okay.
That's the next generation. They were millionaires. The people that they were fighting, the Robber Barons, were millionaires.
Right.
There's quite a lot of millionaires in the second part of the book. But they were the Robber Barons, and then they were the Reformer millionaires. So there was kind of two. But in the beginning, James Turner came when he was about, I think, 15 years old, and his father died, and they had a small farm in Leoni, and they moved to Jackson, and he became a merchant. He went actually door to door at first for a shop owner in Jackson, and then got his own shop with a man named H.H. Smith, who was Hiram H. Smith. The two of them were in Mason, and eventually he and these friends all settled in Mason. So that's where they began at first. And then he got into being a land agent and borrowing money from the Bank of Rochester as part of his land agency work for them. And that built things up. But we were in a depression when our capital was founded. Did you know that?
No, I don't recall that.
No,
detail.
You don't. I had no idea either.
The James Turner came from the Finger Lakes district of New York State, not far from the city of Lansing, New York, I'm told.
Yes.
Did the Turners play a role in the naming of Lansing, Michigan?
They didn't. Some of the others, family named North, were the ones who sort of lobbied the legislature to change the name. The original name was going to be Michigan, Michigan, like New York, New York. But people didn't like that so well. And Mr. North was from Lansing in New York, and so he got them to change it to Lansing.
No, but the family's life reads like a history book of the entire 19th century. They were involved in railroads and infrastructure and the anti-slavery movement.
Yes.
And higher education.
Yes.
For women. Did they have the influence, or did they acquire the influence to sway popular opinion?
Yes, they were very persuasive. And, for instance, the Female College, which is on the campus of the School for the Blind, formed a board. And by the time I got to studying them, I knew a great many of the people of the 19th century in Michigan. And their board was the most powerful people in the state. It was the former governor, Russell Alger, the coming governor, H.P. Baldwin. It was the wealthiest man at the time, E.B. Ward. Top leaders. So they were a group who worked together throughout this period of the 19th century until they died off and the second generation takes over. But that included Zachariah Chandler, who was a leader in Congress for the Civil War. They were so strong as abolitionists that some of them who were Democrats left the Democratic Party. The Whigs joined in with them. They formed the Republican Party together. And there is no question what they were about. They were about ending slavery. That was their main goal.
Were they active in, so they were active in the abolitionist movement before the Civil War?
Yes.
Prior to the war?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you would say that the Turners helped shape the political mindset of the time?
Yes.
Okay. And were they considered part of the populist movement?
In the second part of the book, James M. Turner follows in the footsteps of his father. He becomes something of a folk hero. He's 6'4". He was known all over the state and beloved in the Upper Peninsula. And he was a populist, and he became a millionaire. It was because he started out as a land looker, which is kind of like a surveyor. He's actually out looking at the land and finding out what's there. That's how far back it goes.
Okay.
They didn't even know. And in that process, he learned a lot about minerals and mining and made money as selling lumber and in buying property like his father had done. He became a millionaire. But his whole family's orientation was generous, kind, caring, honest. All these characteristics stayed with the family through the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And how many generations of Turners were really influential?
Well, through James M. Turner, who died in the latter part of the book. But the family continued when Abby married Frank Dodge, and the daughters of James and Marion Turner married men who were then Democrats and populists and followers of William Jennings Bryan. So their values stayed the same, but the party changed.
Okay. We're talking with Elizabeth Homer, a former curator of the Turner Dodge Mansion in Lansing, and the author of the new book, Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires, which officially launches next Tuesday. What did you find in your research that surprised you? Was there anything that contradicted what you thought you knew about the Turner family after all your years as the curator of the Turner Dodge House?
Not contradicted, but it's like we knew the tip of the iceberg. We had no real idea of what they were really about. And it was through Marion Turner's scrapbooks that I began to see where this story was going and what they were involved in, because she saved clippings from the family and also from issues of the time that they were following, like the whole battle over the silver versus gold, which is something kind of vague to us, but for them, it was a key issue because it had to do with inflation and how well farmers could borrow money and pay it back and so forth.
Did any members of the Turner family, were they ever elected to office?
Yes, they were. James Turner was a senator, and then James N. Turner was a member of the House. All the people in the book that were this group of friends was held office at one time or another. All the adult pioneer men were involved with the Civil War, but they were more like in the administration of Austin Blair, who was the governor. You know, this wonderful statue we have out in front of our Capitol?
Of course, yeah.
It's He was from the same place, Casanova, that James Turner was from. He went to the school there. And so all these people knew each other beforehand, and they came here, and they worked together and supported each other. And another was John Longyear. He was another friend and a relative, because the Marion's sister had married John Longyear. And he was a leader in Congress on the issue of Reconstruction. So that's what the issues get into in the story.
Eventually, the family's influence, apparently it reaches a, you know, they're influential for some number of generations.
Yeah.
And then it begins to wane.
Well, it's because...
As it is with most families, yeah. Family dynasties, I suppose.
Well, James Turner died. James M. Turner died at a young age, too. And that was very sad, because he had the potential, I think, to have been governor himself.
Mm.
But he did it. There's a terrible story in this book. In 1890, he ran for governor. The object was to defeat the clique, the ruling clique in the state, which was the robber barons. The party was run and owned by Senator James McMillan, who was a railroad man. And so he...
The party, the what party?
The Republican Party.
The Republican.
The whole... The state was... Once we became Republican in Michigan, everyone was Republican. The Democrats were very much out. Remember, the Democrats were in the hands of the South.
Okay.
And so people here were for abolition. And the Democratic Party had very little leverage at all in politics. But the battle was because the railroads were coming in and taking over the party, and James McMillan was one of those examples. So James M. Turner ran against him in the primary, and this was the most horrible political campaign I had ever read about. It was just awful, except for perhaps with the exception of the last one we had for president.
Learn much more in the new book, Pioneers. If that's not a plug for the book, I don't know what is, Elizabeth.
Yes.
Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires is the new book. Elizabeth Homer was the curator of the Turner Dodge House in Lansing for a number of years, and now she adds author to that. She is also the former curator of the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame. The book, Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires, formally launches April 29th. Liz Homer, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's fun to be here.
On the last day of Saturday of every April, people around the world celebrate World Tai Chi Day. The event, which started in 1999, celebrates the ancient Chinese martial art. Michiganders will join in on the festivities this weekend. Bob Teachout is the founder of Full Circle Tai Chi. He also conducts workshops throughout the state. He joined me in the studio to share some more about this Saturday's event and explain the principles of Tai Chi.
So the beginning is posture. We pay particular attention to posture. Tai Chi gets a lot of credit for improving our sense of awareness of balance and improving balance in a lot of cases. And part of that comes from posture. The second principle is relaxation, that as we go through the exercise, that we maintain relaxation throughout the body. Awareness of the breath. Our average 16 breaths per minute during Tai Chi practice will slow down to 8 or maybe 10 breaths per minute. So that's the third principle. And then the motion. In motion, we are slow, continuous, circular. It's a very fluid kind of action.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth principle is awareness or attention. You know, and so here I make the comparison to cardiovascular exercises that we do here in the West, where attention isn't generally part of the governing principles. You know, we can have a conversation, we can watch a television monitor, we can read, we can do any number of things while we do our exercise. In Tai Chi, one of the governing principles is that we pay attention, that it becomes an exercise of the mind, and that's where the meditation aspect of Tai Chi comes in.
Qigong is another phrase that's associated with Tai Chi. What is Qigong and how are they related?
Here, the comparison that I like to make is to, again, to mention cardiovascular exercise. When we think of cardiovascular exercise in the West or anywhere in the world, that's a vast umbrella that includes literally hundreds of exercises, right, that raise the pulse and bring on some sweat. In China, Qigong is that umbrella. Qigong is governed by those principles that we just talked about of posture, relaxation, awareness of the breath, and so on. And Tai Chi is a Qigong exercise, probably the most complex one in that it series of motions rather than individual motions.
We're standing up for this part of the interview, so you can walk me through a basic Tai Chi posture or two. What
Sure.
can you show me?
Sure. So we start out with posture, and here we have the feet hip to shoulder width apart. The knees are soft, which not to squat, but just so there's a little bit of cushion in that
Sure.
stance.
Okay.
Right? And then, without getting too elaborate, the rest of the posture is a natural posture. We want to stand up straight but relaxed, shoulders obviously on top of the hips, the head in a relatively neutral position, being aware that we're not looking down or looking up. And so that's our posture. So we become aware that all the parts of the body are stacked up, right? We have this feeling of equilibrium as we stand here. We can feel the distribution of weight across the span of the foot. We can feel equal amount of weight.
Is this like alignment?
Yeah,
are we aligned?
Very much. Getting in alignment with the earth, right. And then for motions, let's just start out with the opening movement from many traditional forms, and that is just that we have the hands and the arms lifting up in front of us, gently extended. They lift up to about shoulder height, and then the hands draw in. The elbows are coming down. And then we press down. So you stay relaxed and you feel that as a circle. And we can also do it with the breath. So we breathe in as the hands are coming up, drawing in, the elbows going down, and pressing down.
Okay. Typically, that's the beginning posture?
Right, and it also is the last time until the end of a Tai Chi form that we have our weight equally distributed across the feet. Throughout the rest of the form, we're taking steps and we're shifting the weight back and forth from one foot to another while the entire time maintaining that attention to our balance and to our posture, that we stay upright, that we not lean into our forward steps, lean away from our backward steps.
Why did you decide to become a teacher?
I practiced for a long time. I was largely self-taught until about 10 or 12 years ago, I guess it was. And I had gotten to a point where I was a pretty serious student. I was practicing literally every day. I was reading books. I was watching video. So I considered myself a good student. And then after several years, you know, maybe 8 or 10 years maybe of everyday practice, somewhere the thought came in that, you know, I would maybe like to teach this. But I had no clue how I would go about doing that because it was a very insular world for me. I practiced by myself. As I said, I was largely self-taught. But I subscribed to a magazine, Tai Chi Magazine. It's the most widely distributed international magazine on the art in the world.
Okay.
And I'd been subscribing to it for a very long time. And one time I'm reading a new issue. This was in 2000. And there was a little ad for an Australian doctor that was going to be coming to Lansing to teach a Tai Chi form that he had developed called Tai Chi for Arthritis. And he would spend a weekend with you, and you'd get a little certificate, and you get his endorsement to start teaching his Tai Chi form. And I knew instantly that that was my inroad.
Okay.
That was where I was gonna, how I was gonna set it in motion, and that's just the way it worked.
Besides arthritis, what are the other health benefits to practicing Tai Chi?
The studies are ongoing, so the list continues to grow. One of the things that World Tai Chi and Qigong Day does through a weekly newsletter is keeps us up to date on research. And there are research studies going on and completed for Tai Chi for MS, for Parkinson's disease, for high blood pressure, for heart disease, for just balance and equilibrium issues. It spans an incredibly large scope of the things that we suffer from nowadays, and really the reason for that is pretty simple in my view of it, and that's because Tai Chi stimulates circulation, it stimulates respiration, it manipulates all the joints in the body, the ligaments, the tendons, the muscles, gentle massages of the internal organs through the variety of movements that we have. And as a meditative art, because it's exercising our muscle of attention, it's also reducing the stress in our lives. So when you think about improving respiration, circulation, and reducing stress, there is a formula for health.
We're talking with Bob Teachout, founder of Full Circle Tai Chi in Lansing, about World Tai Chi Day, which is being marked this Saturday in Patriarch Park in East Lansing. This event goes back in time a ways?
Yeah, it started in 1998 in Kansas City. A gentleman named Bill Douglas held his Tai Chi Club, the Kansas City Tai Chi Club, held a public event in a prominent place, and apparently promoted it pretty well because there was a couple of hundred people there. And he also got the interest of CNN Headline News, and they covered the event. His original intention wasn't to make this an international event. He just wanted to do this thing for his community, a large community, but for his community. But because of the CNN coverage, a lot of interest was generated very quickly, and then that seeded the idea that maybe that this could be an international event. And now, this year, there are 80 nations represented, hundreds of cities in all around the world, in Australia, Asia, Africa, all over the United States.
How long has there been an event here in Lansing?
This is the fourth official event here in Lansing.
The event is a collaboration between you and other teachers. What's happening at the gathering?
We have 2 hours, basically, of instruction and demonstration, primarily instruction, although there will be some demonstration. My partner in planning and organizing, a woman named Jan Nestel, who was a student of mine for almost 10 years, and then for the last 5 years has been teaching herself and has gone on to become quite a popular teacher. She and I plan it and organize the event, and then we each teach a small section of it. So along with Jan and myself in organizing the event, we also have 2 other teachers that bring their own teachings. And one is Tim Bernath Playstead, who's been practicing for 40 years, teaching for 25 years, most of it in the Lansing area for creative wellness. And the other person, Belinda Thurston. Belinda established the donation-based Just Be Yoga Studio and runs that full-time now, but she teaches classes in yoga and Tai Chi. And Belinda has also won gold medals in national competition in push hands, which is 2-person Tai Chi. So those are the other 2 teachers that are going to be helping Jan and I. The idea is that each of us brings something a little bit different from that palette of exercises because it's vast. When we think about Tai Chi and Qigong, there's just this huge, huge palette of exercises that we can draw from. So the idea is to expose people to a lot of different practices within, and maybe they'll find a little niche for themselves. Maybe they'll approach one of us after class and say, you know, I think I'd really like to check out one of your classes.
Bob Teachout is a founder of Full Circle Tai Chi in Lansing. He teaches weekly classes in Lansing and conducts workshops around Michigan. And he is also an organizer of World Tai Chi Day this Saturday in Patriarch Park in East Lansing. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
That's our program for today. We're glad you could join us. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll preview the second part of the Wharton Center's 2014-15 season, and we'll have live music from Mighty Medicine, that and more, Friday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Instroth is the producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Libby Lussenhop for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.